This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, we look at rising Islamophobia and hate crimes against Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians in the U.S. as Chicago area Islamic centers are attacked after a congressman says radical Muslims are, quote, trying to kill Americans every week. A U.S. federal court upholds the state secrets privilege, foregoing the rights of Muslim citizens, and bus ads in San Francisco call Palestinians savages. Zahra Bilou, the executive director of the San Francisco chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, will join us to talk about these incidents and much more.
Last night, we went public with another story out of Illinois where vandals had drawn graffiti all over headstones at a Muslim graveyard, written things like raghead, terrorist, etc.
Also, an Israeli high court decision enables the widespread torture of Palestinian detainees. The Israeli army sentences a soldier to just 45 days in prison for his killing of a Palestinian mother and her daughter in Gaza, who were shot while waving white flags during Israel's attacks in 2008 to 2009. The UK Guardian has hired a new contributor who openly called on the Israeli army to kill Americans sailing to Gaza, including Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and Kinder Transport refugee Hedy Epstein. Palestinian refugees forced out of Iraq feared lost at sea en route to Australia, and a South African government official tells citizens not to visit Israel because it mistreats Palestinians. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We first turn our attention to expanding Islamophobia in the United States and widespread violence against Arabs, Muslims, and people of South Asian descent that is being allowed to flourish under the Obama administration. This week, the Electronic Intifada's Maureen Murphy wrote, quote, "At a town hall meeting in suburban Chicago last Wednesday, August 8th, Congressman Joe Walsh warned that, quote, radical Islam is, quote, a real threat, which is much more at home now than it was after 9/11. That threat is, quote, in Elk Grove, it's in Addison, it's in Elgin, Representative Walsh said, referring to Chicago suburbs. He added that radical Muslims are, quote, trying to kill Americans every week, and that, quote, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when a major terrorist attack will happen again in the U.S. Representative Walsh's Islamophobic tirade came just days after a gunman murdered six persons at a gurdwara, a Sikh house of worship in suburban Milwaukee, about a 90-minute drive from Chicago. The suspect, who died of a self-inflicted bullet wound at the scene, was a former U.S. Army psychological operations specialist with longstanding ties to white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. The Department of Homeland Security is treating the shooting as a case of domestic terrorism. Sikh Americans, along with other communities, have been targeted in anti-Muslim hate violence in the last decade. 4 days after Representative Walsh's warning of radical Islam being the enemy within, a man who lives next to a mosque in Morton Grove, a Chicago suburb, shot the building with a high-velocity air rifle while 500 worshippers were inside for evening prayers during Ramadan. Meanwhile, our correspondent Charlotte Silver wrote that a federal court ruled this week in favor of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which had invoked the state secrets privilege to dismiss a class action lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Southern California on behalf of several members of the Muslim community in Orange County. The plaintiffs had charged the FBI with violating their constitutional rights by targeting them for indiscriminate surveillance merely because of their religion. Silver added, quote, the surveillance began in June 2006 when an undercover FBI informant, Craig Montiel, was sent into a variety of, quote, mainstream mosques in Orange County, California, posing as an Islamic convert. The FBI codenamed this assignment Operation Flex. Montiel testified that one of his superiors had said, quote, we want to get as many files on this community as possible. Montiel, who worked on this assignment until October 2007, testified to collecting information on around 10 different mosques. The ACLU, along with the Council for American-Islamic Relations of Greater Los Angeles and a private firm, filed the class action lawsuit in February 2011. The Obama administration argued that any divulgence of specifics to the case would, quote, cause significant harm to the national security. And also this week, the Electronic Intifada reported on an advertisement campaign spearheaded by Pamela Geller, a notorious anti-Muslim insider who leads the American Freedom Defense Initiative, an Islamophobic Israel lobby organization which has been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Geller's ads, which are currently being displayed on several buses in San Francisco, state, quote, "In any war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man. Support Israel. Defeat jihad." The ads have drawn outrage from many in the Bay Area, including civil rights and human rights organizations who have appealed to the San Francisco Municipal Transit Agency to take action. The San Francisco MTA had apparently approved the ads after Pamela Geller took New York City to court after the transportation agency rejected the same ads on their bus system. A federal judge ruled that New York violated Geller's group's First Amendment rights by rejecting the ads. Geller said she would sue San Francisco if they didn't accept her ads in the city. However, in a press release on Wednesday, several Bay Area civil rights and human rights organizations announced that the San Francisco MTA said it would direct all the ad revenue to the city's Human Rights Commission. Joining us to talk about the current situation with the rise of Islamophobia in the U.S. is Zahra Bilou, the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Zahra, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks for having us. For me.
So first off, talk about the general climate from coast to coast as we've seen a spike in hate crimes and violence against Arabs and Muslims and South Asians in the last several weeks, with little to no response by the Obama administration. And there have been around 8 to 9 incidents in the past 2 weeks alone. Actually, why don't you start by talking about what's happening in Chicago, which seems to be an epicenter of violence and hate crimes against Muslims?
Yeah, it's crazy. I think I've lost count at this point. I remember earlier in the week thinking it was 7 or 8, and now I sort of just wake up in the morning hoping I don't hear about another hate crime. Last night, we went public with another story out of Illinois where vandals had drawn graffiti all over headstones at a Muslim graveyard, written things like raghead, terrorist, et cetera, and it was just really frightening. Like, I mean, there's something that can be said about people who disrespect the dead in that way. And so that's actually the third major hate incident in Illinois in just the last 2 weeks. And as much as things have been spread out across the country, it's been interesting to note that in Illinois, where one of their elected officials, you know, held a press conference and talked about Islam being the threat, it was followed by some of these major incidents. Someone firing a gun at a Muslim institution, someone throwing a bottle of acid at an Islamic school, and now someone tagging all over Muslim gravestones at a graveyard.
What has been the response by the local community and civil rights groups, including CARE, to what's happening in Illinois, but also across the country?
I think for both community leaders and civil rights groups, it's really important to balance raising awareness of the issues and making sure people know what's going on so that they can push back against Islamophobia in their circles, but also not raising the level of fear. And so we walk this really fine line of wanting to make sure people know everything so that they can be informed, making sure that they're not scared. And so we've been advising people of their rights, urging people to call for help if anything happens, right? It's important to be, and then advising them to be incredibly vigilant, that if you see something outside of your mosque or your place of worship that doesn't seem ordinary, if someone says something to you, if someone is harassing someone, it's really important that these things be documented. So often our communities don't report the little things because of exactly that. They see them as the little things. The problem, however, is the little things quite often spiral into larger incidents. And so having a pulse on it very early on allows both civil rights groups and community organizations to be able to better serve the community.
And here in California, there was a recent suit that I mentioned in the intro, right, that the ACLU brought in Orange County against the FBI's ongoing surveillance of Muslims. And the government's position essentially was that we're going to keep doing this and you're not going to stop us. Can you talk about how that's been reverberating in the community and what that means for Muslim centers and communities in California?
Right. So the lawsuit in Southern California is actually one of the most frightening cases of FBI abuse of the community that we have seen in years. And so in that case, just for folks who aren't familiar with it, the FBI sent in an ex-convict who was paid a six-figure salary to pretend to be Muslim and engage the Orange County Muslim community in various ways. So he would hang out at the gym and work out with like various members of the Muslim community there. He would socialize with women and has like alleged that he was egged on to fraternize with them and develop intimate relations with them. He was always at the mosque, and what he would do is he would incite people, start to talk about violence in the religion, wanting to engage in jihad, so much so that he actually frightened the community, and they sought a restraining order on him. And when that happened, the FBI stopped paying him. because he was no longer an effective informant. And everything fell out of control, and the community learned, wait, this man that we were afraid of was actually sent to us to harass us by the FBI. And so the ACLU, CARE, a number of private lawyers, and several named individuals filed a class action a couple of years ago saying, you know, this is not okay. Like, you have violated our rights. And earlier this week, the court said that, you know, that this is permissible. The court essentially bought the Obama administration's argument that if they were to allow this to be litigated, that it would expose state secrets. That's a very frightening precedent at two levels. This is one of the very first times that state secrets has been cited in a domestic case to prevent the litigation of civil rights abuses in the United States. It also sets a very frightening precedent because it sends a clear signal to the community that there is very little legal recourse, if any, to having informants infiltrate their mosques, to having the FBI harass them whenever they so choose, and for no other reason than the fact that they are Muslim. What is more frightening, I think, for someone who is a worshiper going to the mosque thinking, you know, I just want to go to my house of worship, it's my sanctuary, I just want to focus on my prayer and my spirituality, and not knowing if the person next to you has been planted there by the FBI. And yet, again, as civil rights groups, we walk this fine line of, you know, trying to ensure that people are not so frightened that they can't exercise their rights, and at the same time are vigilant of the reality of civil rights abuses happening around them.
And finally, Zahra Bilou, talk a little bit about the hate ads in San Francisco, the advertisements on city buses that infer that Palestinians are savages and that Israelis are the civilized man. Tell us about what's happening there and the community's response here in the Bay Area by civil rights groups and by, you know, regular people on the street.
Sure. So last week we started to receive complaints about ads on muni buses in San Francisco that read essentially, in a war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man, support Israel, defeat jihad. And people were concerned and frightened and thinking, you know, what the heck? This is San Francisco. What's going on? Like, the message is so clearly racist in one referencing sort of the word savage, which has sort of a historical racist use targeting communities of color, but also sort of implying that Arabs, Muslims, and Palestinians are savages, talking about defeating jihad as if, you know, as if there's this worldwide threat of jihad. And so just a lot of concerns in the community. And so the response that we started to get from the community immediately was outrage and concern. They didn't want to be riding these buses, but they were also outraged that this would happen in their city. And what was really moving for us was that so much of the outrage was coming from people who were not Arab or Muslim, who said, look, as people of conscience, as people of color, as people of faith, this is really offensive, and we don't want to ride these buses. And so a petition was started actually by someone who is a Jewish American, and said, you know, this is crazy. Like, we're not okay with this in our city. And so that petition has been circulating and has been really sort of moved forward by people of other faiths and the people in the labor movement. So that's been really great. The community has mobilized and is actually, in talks with Muni and the Human Rights Commission about the impact that this has had. Earlier this week, Muni made it very clear that they would not be removing the ads because they were likely protected by the First Amendment. It's important to note that Pamela Geller, the woman behind the organization that is buying these ads across the country, thrives on lawsuits. So she goes from city to city waiting for someone to turn her down so that she can sue them and then use those pending lawsuits to essentially blackmail other cities into submission. So in the case of San Francisco, she had just won a temporary injunction in New York, and San Francisco said, okay, we're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. We'll give her the ad space. And so they caved because of the fear. And I think that that's important to note when we talk about Islamophobia and how people who are promoting anti-Muslim hate are using the courts to actually target the rights and put forward their rhetoric targeting entire communities. And so SFMTA earlier this week issued a statement that was really strong. I mean, it essentially said, you know, we don't see any value in these ads. We recognize that they don't contribute to the cause of peace and justice. However, they also went on to say, you know, we can't pull them because they're protected by the First Amendment, but what we will do is donate the proceeds of these ads to the Human Rights Commission so that they can work on remedying the impacts. So there's a total of $3,800 that they're redirecting from ad revenue to the Human Rights Commission. And the community, while they appreciated this, I think it's important to recognize, is still very, very concerned. As much as even the civil rights groups and the organizations within the community are saying, look, like, as a matter of principle, we're not going to ask for these ads to be pulled, the community is saying, we want them pulled. There's, you know, a meme and a bunch of guerrilla art that's going around as of last night where people have essentially wheat pasted a stamp saying hate speech on the ad. I mean, these are activists who are saying, well, if the organizations and the institutions won't take it down, we'll take matters into our own hands. And that sort of gives you an idea of just how upset people are. I think the other thing going forward for the Arab and Muslim community that's responding to this is that the $3,800 being sent to the Human Rights Commission is great, but it's just the start. That we don't want just that $3,800 and then sort of thank you, have a nice day. That it needs to be that Muni itself runs counter ads that promote diversity. The Human Rights Commission talks to and assesses the impact of these ads. And also, very importantly, that the Arab and Muslim community be involved and at the table as the process develops for these remedies. That this is an issue that directly brings up Islamophobia. Arabs and Muslims are the directly impacted community from these ads. And so to say, you know, we'll let you know what we decide to do isn't sufficient. The community needs to be engaged to develop an appropriate response, and particularly one that doesn't limit free speech on all Israel-Palestine conversations, because that wasn't the community's position. The community's position has been that you can talk about the Israel-Palestine conflict in a manner that is not offensive and hateful, as these ads were.
And very briefly, talk just for a minute about the response by the local Israel lobby organizations who are putting their toe into this water.
Yeah, it was really sort of interesting for us to note that the Jewish Community Relations Council and the Anti-Defamation League were two of the organizations that were earliest to respond to the ads. I think even before any of the Arab or Muslim organizations had put out an official statement. So it's sort of interesting that Pamela Geller's brand of racism and Zionism is so extreme that even institutional and historical Zionist organizations are saying, hey, like, she doesn't represent us. I think the concern that a lot of Arab and Muslim organizations and leaders and individuals have is that while it's great to have allies, this is not a community that is directly impacted by the hate speech in these ads, right? The hate speech in these ads targets the Arab and Muslim community, and so the leadership needs to come from the Arab and Muslim community. The guidance as to how to remedy this needs to come from the Arab and Muslim community. And an overwhelming concern that we have is that because of the parallel work that we are doing supporting student free speech rights and seeing what institutional Zionism is saying about silencing pro-Palestine students on campus, there's actually a concern that, you know, that having any remedies be driven by institutionally Zionist organizations will actually have a negative impact on free speech altogether, because they're going to push what many have tried to call a civility standard, essentially the kind of standard that says, you know, you can't talk about the experience of the human rights violations that Palestinians are experiencing. And that's different, right? That's political speech that talks about actual nation states and what they're doing. Very different from calling an entire country or an entire sort of ethnic group savages. And so As Arab and Muslim organizations, we're saying, hey, we need to be involved in this because we are the impacted community, and involving others is important, but they shouldn't be playing the lead role when they aren't the ones being called savages by these ads that SSMTA ran.
Zahra Bilu, how can people learn more about what's happening and get in touch with CARE?
So people can learn more about what's going on and get in touch with CARE by visiting our website at cair.com. I also encourage people to follow us on Twitter. CAIR National. And I don't say that just to drive up our followers, but also that's actually where we put out some of our most active news. When the news about the graveyard vandalism broke, that was where we put it out first, because that was, you know, where people are paying the most attention. And so I encourage people to get involved in those online conversations as a first step to raising awareness.
All right, Zahra Bilu, she is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations chapter in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Our correspondent Charlotte Silver reported this week that the Israeli High Court ruled against a petition to demand the government carry out a criminal investigation into every allegation of torture by the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Services Agency, or GSS. The petition was submitted by human rights organizations working for the defense of Palestinian detainees and prisoners who have been subjected to torture at the hands of the Shin Bet. Silva writes that since 2000, 700 complaints of torture at the hands of the Shin Bet have been submitted to the state prosecutor's office, and not a single case has been criminally charged, prosecuted, or convicted. When turning back each unresolved complaint, the state prosecutor's office either denies the factuality of the allegations of physical abuse or invokes the, quote, necessity defense, that is, the detainee fell under the, quote, ticking bomb scenario. An attorney and the legal director of the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel said that, quote, the GSS's impunity is absolute. In his ruling against the petition, Justice Eliakim Rubinstein stated, quote, the Shin Bet, of course, is neither above the law nor immune to criticism, but it is clear that there is a place for relevant screening out of consideration for the Shin Bet's work and without feigning innocence, also for fear of false complaints for political and ideological reasons. According to Judge Rubinstein's ruling, the state prosecutor's preliminary examination into complaints is sufficient to determine whether a criminal investigation should be pursued. For much more on this story, visit Charlotte Silver's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. This week, our correspondent Ben White reported that the Israeli army sentenced one of its soldiers to a meager 45 days in prison for his involvement in the shooting death of a Palestinian mother and her daughter in Gaza during the Israeli attacks and invasion in the winter of 2008 to 2009, in which approximately 1,400 Palestinians were killed. The mother and her daughter were waving white flags when they were both shot. Ben White reports, quote, it makes one wonder if the self-styled so-called most moral army in the world has a problem with impunity. In a statement, Reporters Without Borders said that they had on many occasions asked the Israeli army to undertake independent and impartial investigations into such incidents in order to identify and punish those responsible. Even when the army does carry out an investigation, it seldom reaches any real conclusions. A complaint made to the military law enforcement bodies of offenses by soldiers against Palestinians have a 96.5 chance of being dismissed without an indictment being filed against the suspected soldiers. From September 2000 to April 2011, Israeli human rights group Bet Salem demanded a criminal investigation into 304 cases in which soldiers killed Palestinians. From the information available to Bet Salem, it appears that investigations were opened in only 73 of the cases. As far as Bet Salem knows, indictments were filed in 9 of these cases and 23 investigations were closed, with no measures taken against the soldiers. For more on this story, visit Ben White's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima reported this week that, quote, in a sad sign of its deterioration, the UK Guardian has hired a new contributor who openly called on the Israeli army to kill Americans sailing to Gaza, including Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and Kinder Transport refugee Hetty Epstein. In June 2011, as several dozen Americans, including Walker and Epstein, attempted to set sail from Greece to Gaza to break Israel's blockade along with boats from other countries, Joshua Trevino tweeted, quote, Dear IDF, if you end up shooting any Americans on the new Gaza flotilla, well, most Americans are cool with that, including me. IDF is Israel's initialism for the Israeli army. At the time, the Israeli army was itself inciting against Walker and other Americans, calling them, quote, a threat to Israel. Trevino's initial call to murder was directed at journalist Joseph Dana, before Trevino asserted that Israel would be right to kill all flotilla passengers. Trevino, who served on the advisory board of the extreme anti-Palestinian group Act for Israel, also endorsed a call to, quote, sink the flotilla, likening it to a Nazi convoy and the Americans on board to Al-Qaeda. Abu Nima adds, quote, The Guardian has long held a reputation as a progressive and reputable publication. However, the laundering of someone who regards murder as an acceptable form of dealing with people whose opinions he rejects suggests the once venerable newspaper has abandoned any such pretense. The Guardian, which is suffering massive financial losses, is currently undertaking a risky expansion into the U.S. market, and perhaps hopes sensationalism, racism, and calls to murder will help it find favor with American audiences. It also shows that calling for violence against opponents is no bar to advancement in the, quote, liberal Guardian, as long as the victims are standing in solidarity with Palestinians. For more on this story, visit Ali's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. In a developing story, the Electronic Intifada reported on Wednesday that more than 24 Palestinian refugees forced out of Iraq after the U.S. invasion are feared lost at sea, including entire family groups with young children. They were among dozens of people aboard rickety boats that left Indonesia in late June, bound for Australia, but have been lost without a trace for a month and a half. Australia has denied reports that it holds them in detention. The Palestinians were among hundreds who had made circuitous journeys over many years from Iraq to Jordan and then to Cyprus, where their asylum applications were rejected and they faced harsh conditions. After reaching Cyprus, some set out for Malaysia, where it is possible under certain conditions for Palestinians to go without visas, and then onwards to Indonesia, where people smugglers are paid to take them to Australia by boat. Palestinians in Iraq faced violence and persecution after the 2003 U.S. invasion. They were collectively blamed without any evidence for suicide bombings that were part of Iraq's post-invasion sectarian civil war. Many spent years stranded at the Iraq-Jordan border. For much more on this story, including photographs and the names of some of the missing, visit electronicintifada.net/blogs. And now, in news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the Electronic Intifada reported that South Africa's Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation has told the media that, quote, because of the treatment and policies of Israel towards the Palestinian people, we strongly discourage South Africans from going there. The Deputy Minister, Ebrahim Ebrahim, added that this was South Africa's, quote, general policy, but more so in regard to municipalities, since they are part of the government. The minister's comments came in the wake of the cancellation of a visit to Israel by a delegation of mayors and municipal leaders from South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province. The cancellation of the South African mayor's visit comes just months after the South African government decided to require that goods originating from illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank will be labeled as such. This has been seen as a first step towards banning such goods altogether. Ronnie Kasrils, a former minister and one of the legendary founders of the armed wing of the African National Congress during the struggle against apartheid, welcomed the mayor's move. Quote, during the days of apartheid, we had similar attempts by the regime to undermine the isolation of South Africa. It is not surprising that the Israeli lobby is also attempting to ensnare the unwary into boycott-busting trips, Kasrils was quoted as saying in a press release from BDS South Africa. For more information on this story and for more news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features, and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.